an Osho talk. The Discipline of Transcendence. Talks on the 42 Sutras of Buddha. Volume 4, Number 7.
The Buddha asked a monk, "How do you measure the length of a man's life?" The monk answered, "By days." The Buddha said, "You do not understand the way." The Buddha asked another monk, "How do you measure the length of a man's life?" The monk answered, "By the time that passes during a meal." The Buddha said, "You do not understand the way." The Buddha asked a third monk, "How do you measure the length of a man's life?" The monk answered, "By the breath." The Buddha said, "Very well, you know the way."
The Buddha asked a monk, "How do you measure the length of a man's life?" The monk answered, "By days." A very simple question and a very simple answer, but much is implied in the question, and the answer also shows much about the monk, his understanding, his state of mind. When Buddha asks, "How do you measure the length of a man's life?" he is raising a question that can be only answered by depth. Man's life can be measured only by depth. It looks paradoxical. Length can be measured only by depth. In fact, the deeper you live, the longer you live. The length of your life depends on your depth. The quantity of your life depends on your quality. The monk could not understand it. He simply said, "By days." His simple answer also shows much about himself. By days means by time. By days means by the fleeting. By days means by the flux, the changing. He measures life by the momentary, not by the eternal, not by the timeless. Life exists in time, but life does not belong to time. It penetrates time, and one day it disappears from the time. It is just like a ray of sun penetrates water. And when it penetrates the water, its angle changes. That's why if you put a straight stick into water, it will look curved. It will not look straight, because the angle of light changes. And when the ray of light enters into the medium of water, it does not belong there. It has come from beyond. And it will go back, it will be reflected back. Because everything returns to its source, has to return to its source. Only then the circle is complete and there is contentment. When Buddha asks, "How do you measure the length of a man's life?" and the monk replied, "By days," he shows his understanding. He does not know anything beyond time. He thinks life is just all that consists of time. Born, marriage, living, then old age, then death. Days go on flicking by, just like numbers on a gasoline pump. But this is not life. This is just the very periphery. Have you observed that if you look inside, time exists not? If you look outside, there is time, but if you look inside, there is no time. Have you not sometimes, sitting silently with closed eyes, felt it, that inside you have not aged at all? Inside you remain the same as when you were a child, or as when you were young. Inside nothing has changed. The face is wrinkled by age. The hair has gone grey. Death is approaching. This is all from the outside. If you look in the mirror, then of course there are signs that much time has passed, that very little is left, that sooner or later you will be gone. But look within. There has never been any time there. You are exactly the same as you were ever. When you were running in a garden or on the sea beach and collecting colored stones and sea shells, just remember, inside you are exactly the same this moment too. Time is a fallacy as far as the inner world is concerned, because in the inner world nothing ever changes. It remains the same. Its taste remains the same. In the inner world, time is simply irrelevant, and life is in the inner. It expresses in the outside, but it does not belong to the outside. It wells up from your within. It moves outwards like ripples. It pulsates outwards, but it arises from your innermost core. When Buddha was asking, how do you measure the life of a man? In a very simple question, he was asking a very complicated philosophical question too. And the monk was deceived. And the monk said by days, but there is no day, no night. Time is a utilitarian concept. It is needed outside. When you are alone, time is not needed. It is a relationship between you and others. It is a relative concept. Try to find it out, and you will be surprised that believing in time, you have been believing in an illusion. Because that which does not correspond to your inner reality cannot be real. It is just like money. If you go to the market, it has value. If you simply sit alone with your money, it has no value. The value comes only when you relate with others, because the value is just an agreement between you and the others. That's why money has a beautiful name. It is called currency. Currency means when money moves, it has value. When it does not move, it has no value. If you go on keeping it in your pocket always and always, it is meaningless. You can keep anything else instead of it, it will be the same. Money has value when it changes hands. From one hand to another, then there is value. Value is in its being a currency, a moving force. When it moves from you to somebody else, it has value. Again, if it is stuck there, it loses value. That's why miserly people are the poorest in the world. They have money, but they don't know that money has value only when it is a currency. You can hide it in your treasure chest. You will remain poor. Time is also a currency. Between two people, between relationship, between society. But in the inner world, when you are alone, it is simply meaningless. All the concepts of time, if looked deeply, look very stupid. But people don't look deeply into things because to look deeply creates anxiety. Then you become very anxious. Then settled things are unsettled. And whenever something is unsettled, one feels anxious. One wants to be settled again. People say time passes. But where it passes to? From where it comes? You say it comes from the future and goes into past. That means future exists before it has become present. Otherwise, from where it is coming? From nowhere? From nothingness? And then you say it goes into the past. That means it goes on collecting in the past. It is still there. It still exists. Then what is the difference between present, past and future if they all exist? Then they are all present. Then there is no past and no future. You say a moment that has passed is past. And a moment that has to come is future. You stand on a road. You have walked 2 miles. That has passed. But those 2 miles exist, you can look back. Those 2 miles are still there. And if you want to go back, you can go back. But can you go back in time? Look back, nothing exists. Except this present moment, on both the sides there is simply smoke and nothing. The past simply disappears. And the future appears out of nothing. And then a problem arises. If in the beginning there is nothing, and in the end again there is nothing, how there can be something between two nothings? It is impossible. Time is not a valid concept at all. It is just utilitarian. It is accepted. It has utility. Every morning you come 8 o'clock. If there is no time, it will be difficult. When you will come, how you will manage, and how there will be a possibility of me meeting you, it will become difficult. But remember, it is just an agreement. It is not truth. Truth is timeless. Time is a human invention. Truth is eternal. In fact, time does not pass, we pass. We come and go, time remains. Then time is not time, then it is eternity. Buddha was asking all these things in a simple question. The man said, by days, Buddha said, you do not understand the way. The man's understanding was very superficial. We can call it the understanding on the level of body. Of course, body has a clock in it. Now the scientists say the biological clock. That's why if you eat every day at 1 o'clock, your lunch time, then every day at 1 o'clock the body will say you are hungry. The body has a clock. You need not look at the clock actually. If you listen to your body, the body will tell you, now it is time to sleep, because every day you go to sleep at this time. And you can put even alarm in your body clock. When you are going to sleep, you can repeat your own name loudly 3 times. If your name is Ram, you can say, Ram, listen, I have to get up at 5 o'clock. Help me. Talk to your body and go to sleep. And exactly 5 o'clock, your body will wake you. The body has a clock. That's why every month, after exactly 4 weeks, 28 days, comes the monthly period to a woman. The body manages very exactly. Unless something has gone with the body wrong, the woman may have disturbances. Otherwise, exactly 28 days. If the clock is functioning well, there will be never any problem. 28 days means 28 days. After 9 months, the body is ready to give birth to a child. Exactly after 9 months. If the woman is healthy, and there is no complication in her body, it will happen exactly at the moment 9 months are complete. The body carries a clock and functions perfectly well. The body, of course, is measured by days. And the body shows every sign of passing time. Young, old, you can see on the body. The body carries the whole biography. This man's understanding was very physical, very superficial. The Buddha asked another monk, how do you measure the length of a man's life? The monk answered, by the time that passes during a meal, his understanding goes a little deeper. He is less physical and more psychological. To enjoy a meal, you need a mind. To indulge, you need a mind. To be sensual, you need a mind. This man's understanding is a little deeper. What he is saying that a man's life is measured by the pleasures, indulgences, sensuality, experiences that he has gathered in his life. The man is saying, how long you live is not the point, how much you enjoy the pleasures of life. There is a story about Nero, the Roman emperor. He must have been of the exact type like this second monk. He had 2 physicians always with him. He will eat and the physicians will help him to vomit. Then he will eat again. You cannot go on eating. There is a limitation. So when he will feel that now the stomach is full, he will order the physician to help him vomit. Then he can eat again. He will eat 10, 12 times a day. And don't think that this is very far-fetched. I have come across few people who do it. There was one sannyasin. She told me after she was here at least for 2 years. She said that I am ashamed, but I have to tell it to you. That every day when I eat, I vomit immediately. I said, why? She said, so that I can eat more. But then I vomit again. Now vomiting has become a habit. Now she cannot resist. When she eats, she has to vomit. It has become a mechanical habit. It took almost 6 months to break her habit. Nero must have done it. Ordinarily, you may not be vomiting, but you can go on eating too much. There are people who live to eat. It is good to eat. It is good to eat to live. But once you start living for eating, then you are in a very confused state. Eating is a means, not the end. This monk says, by the time that passes during a meal, he must have been a glutton. He must have understood only one language, that is of taste. He must have been a food addict. He says that if we count real life, then real life means those moments in which we were enjoying, indulging. Maybe food, maybe sex, or other gratifications. Many people are of that type. Their philosophy seems to be eat, drink, be merry. And there is nothing else in life. There has been a great philosopher in India, Charvaka. This was his message to his disciples, that eat, drink and be merry. And don't bother about the other life and soul and God. This is all nonsense. These are just theories invented by the priests to exploit you. He was the first Marxian. Marx came after 3,000 years. He was the first Marxist communist. But if life is just eating, drinking, indulging, then it cannot have any meaning. That's why in the West a new problem has become very, very important. And the problem is, what is the meaning of life? All intelligent people are asking that in the West. Why? Nobody asks it in the East. But in the West, the problem has become almost epidemic. And it is no more academic. Everybody is asking, what is the meaning of life? And they are asking at a wrong time, when they have enough to eat, enough to drink, and enough to be merry. Why they are asking this question? In fact, when you have all that this world can give to you, then arises the question, what is the meaning of it? Yesterday you ate, today you are eating, tomorrow also you will eat. So what is the point? Eating and defecating. From one end you go on stuffing yourself, from another end you go on emptying yourself. Is this your whole life? And in between there is a little taste on the tongue. It seems absurd. The effort seems to be too much and the result seems to be nothing, almost nothing. man needs to have a meaning, but the meaning can come only from the higher. The meaning always comes from the beyond. Unless you feel related to something higher, you feel meaningless. Because Nietzsche said God is dead, he opened the door for many ugly phenomena. For example, Nazism, fascism, communism became possible. Because once there is no God, that door is closed from where man has always felt meaning in his life. Meaning arises when you feel that you are part of a divine plan. When you feel that you are part of a divine fellow. When you feel that you are part of a great whole, then you have meaning. A brick in itself has no meaning, but when it becomes part of a great palace, part of Taj Mahal, it has meaning. It has contributed something to the beauty of Taj Mahal. It is not futile. It is significant. When God is not there, man started finding new meanings to his life, become part of a party, the great communist party, or the great fascist party. Become part. Then Stalin and Adolf Hitler became gods. Then join hands with them so that you can feel a little meaning, that you are not alone, that you are not just accidental, that you have some mission to fulfill. Maybe you are here to bring communism in the world, a classless society in the world, or you are here to bring the kingdom of the Aryans. Then one becomes part of a Hindu religion, Christian, Mohammedan. One finds some way, somewhere, to become part of something. And people go to fullest lengths. People become Rotarians and Lions. Just to have a feeling that you are part of an international organization. And you are somehow chosen. You are a Rotarian. Everybody cannot be a Rotarian. Only very few people can be Rotarians. You are a Rotarian. So you have a meaning, but what fullest meaning? What does it matter whether you are a Rotarian or not? It really does not bring meaning to your life. It simply deceives you. You can eat well. You can live well. You can have all the pleasures of life, still you will remain empty. This man, the second monk, said that life is to be measured by pleasure, by indulgence, by sensuality. But Buddha said, you do not understand the way. Because the way cannot be understood by the body-oriented mind, and the way cannot be understood by mind-oriented mind. Neither it can be understood through time, nor it can be understood through experience. The way is beyond time and beyond experience. The Buddha asked the third monk, how do you measure the length of a man's life? The monk answered, by the breath. The Buddha said, very well, you know the way. Now, in an English translation, saying by breath does not seem to be so significant as it would have appeared to Buddha when the monk must have said by prana. Breath is a translation of prana. But prana is much more meaningful than breath. Actual translation closer to truth will be spirit, not breath. And the word spirit exists in such words as inspiration. expiration. Spirit seems to be closer home. It's still not exactly true. So let me first explain you what prana is, then you will be able to understand. Otherwise it looks a little absurd. The man says by breath, and Buddha says, well, you know the way very well. Just the man says by breath. The first thing, if you look at yourself, you will find there is the body, the first circle around you, your outermost circle. Then there is your mind, the second circle within the circle, within the first circle. And then you will come to a bridge. That bridge is your breath, prana. By that bridge you are joined with the soul. That's why when a person stops breathing, we say he is dead. The bridge is broken. Now the soul is separate and the body is separate. When a child is born, the first thing he is expected to do is to breathe. By breath, the soul and body become joined together. And the last thing he will do again when he will die will be a stopping breath. Again, there will be a divorce. The body and soul will be separate. Prana is the bridge, the glue, by which you are glued together. A man can live by without food for many days. You can live without water for many hours. But without breath, you cannot live even for many minutes. Even seconds will seem difficult. Breath is the bridge between matter and no matter, between the form and the formless, between the world and God, or whatsoever terms you choose. Breath is the bridge, and much depends on the breath, how you breathe. What is the quality of your prana? Much depends on it. Watch. When you are angry, you breathe in one way. When you are silent, you breathe in another way. The pulse is different. The rhythm is different. The quality is different. When you are angry, your breath is not rhythmic, not musical, not harmonious. It is bumpy. When you are in a passion, in sexual passion, again, the breath is feverish. It is not in tune. Something goes wrong with breathing. When you are sitting silently, just being peaceful, not doing anything, no desire, no passion, no anger, just full of compassion, full of love, your breathing is very soft. Your breathing has a rhythm to it, a dance to it. It has no violence, no aggression. It is very delicate. Have you watched it? When you are in passion, your breathing will have a very bad odor to it. When you are peaceful, your breathing will have a very sweet smell to it. Because you are at ease. The whole being is at ease. You are at home. The breathing will carry the message that you are at home. There are moments of deep meditation when breathing almost stops. I say almost, it does not stop really. But it becomes so silent that you cannot feel it. You can feel it only if you put a mirror close to your nose. Then on the mirror you can feel it, otherwise you cannot feel it. Those are rare moments of blessing and benediction. All the yoga systems of the world have worked on breathing. Because it is through the breathing that you will pass from the body to nobody. It is through breathing that you will enter into the innermost core of your existence. The monk is right when he says, a man's life is to be measured by the way he breathes. How he breathes. If you are afraid, your breathing is different. You are nervous, your breathing is different. You are sad, your breathing is different. With every mood, your breathing changes. The breathing goes on showing where you are. If you can watch your breathing, you will learn the whole alphabet of your inner changing climates. All the moods you can see reflected in the breathing. Breathing is a great way to measure where you are, what you are, what you are doing. Buddha emphasized very much on the breathing. And his emphasis is unique. It is very different from Patanjali. It is very different from Hatha Yoga. It is very different from other systems, all other systems. He says, don't use any system for breathing. Because if you do something with breathing, you will create something artificial. Let breathing be natural. You simply watch it. You don't do anything to it. You simply be a witness. You simply look at it. Now, if you watch breathing, by and by you will see you are different from breathing. Certainly, because the watcher cannot be the watched. The subject cannot be the object. The observer cannot be the observed. When you start watching your breathing, and Buddha says continuously do it, walking, sitting, whenever you are not doing anything else, just watch your breathing. Go on seeing it. By seeing it, a great serenity will arise in you. Because you will be standing behind breathing. And behind the breathing is your soul. You will be centered in your soul. And if you watch breathing, you will learn subtle changes in breathing. So, where you are. And continuously, breathing functions like a measuring rod. And slight changes in breathing when awareness is full will be noted. And you can drop then and there. You can become more alert. If you feel your breathing is wavering a little, and you feel that this wavering is the wavering that comes when sex takes possession, then it is the moment to become more aware. And if the wavering breathing settles again, you have passed. That desire that was going to possess will not be able to possess you. By and by you become aware what type of changes happen in breathing when you become angry. They are so subtle that if you can become aware when the breathing changes slightly, they can be dropped from there because they are right in the seed. And the seed can be dropped easily. When they become a big tree, it is very difficult to drop them. You become aware of anger only when it has already possessed you. your diagnosis is too late. In Soviet Russia, they have developed a new photography. They call it Kirlian. And now Kirlian photographers say that we can catch hold of a disease 6 months before it really happens to the person. And if it can be done, then there will be no need for anybody to be ill. The person himself is not aware that he will be falling a victim of tuberculosis after 6 months. How you can be aware of that? But before it enters into the body, first it enters prana. Before it enters the body, first it enters your energy. Bioplasma, they call it in Russia. It is exactly what by prana we mean. Bioplasma. Your vitality. Your body electricity. First it enters into the body electricity. And then it takes 6 months to be transformed into a physical phenomenon. Then it becomes solid in the body. Then it is already too late. When you start treating it, it is already too late. If you could have caught it when it was in the bioplasma, you could have destroyed it very, very easily. There was no problem in it. And the body would have never suffered. Body would not even have known about it. Buddha says, anything that enters into the bioplasma first happens into your breathing. Anything that happens to your body, to your mind, first happens to your breathing. Maybe someday, Kirlian photographers will be able to rediscover the fact that there is certain association between the pulse of bioplasma and breathing. It has to be so. Because when you breathe deeply, you have a bigger aura that has been photographed. When you breathe deeply, you have more oxygen and more flowing energy, and your body has a bigger aura, more luminosity to it. When you breathe in a dull way, your whole lungs are not full of oxygen, and you go on carrying much stale carbon dioxide, then your aura shrinks and becomes very small. A really alive person has a very big aura. So big that when he comes close to you, his aura touches your aura. And you will feel it. There are people with whom you will feel suddenly as you are attracted, pulled, irresistible. You would like to come close to them, closer and closer. Their aura has touched your aura. Then there are people whose auras are almost dead, does not exist at all. They repel. They don't attract. They are like dead people. Nobody feels attracted towards them. Buddha says, watch, become aware of your breathing. His yoga is called Anapanasati Yoga. The yoga of watching the breath coming in and watching the breath going out. He says this is enough. So when the monk said, by the breath, Buddha said, very well, you know the way. The Buddha's way has 10 grounds called bhumis. Bhumi means ground. Buddha has said that if you understand that these 10 grounds, and if you practice these 10 grounds, you will attain to the ultimate. And I would like to go into these 10 bhumis, 10 grounds. They are very practical. The first bhumi, pramudita, it means joyousness. Now you will be surprised. People have a misunderstanding about Buddha and his teaching. They think that he is a very sad, pessimistic thinker. He is not. His first grounding is joyousness. He says, unless you are joyous, you will never reach to the truth. Joyousness, delight, celebration, that is the meaning of pramudita. Be like a flower. Open, dancing in the breeze, and joyous. Only joy can take you to the other soul. If you are not joyous, your very sadness will function like a rock in your neck and will drown you. People are not drowned by anything else than their own sadness and pessimistic outlooks. Life has to be joyous. Then life becomes spiritual. If your church is sad, then that church exists for death, not for life. A church, a temple has to be joyous. If you come to a saint and he has no sense of humor, escape from him. Beware. He can kill you. He will prove poisonous. If he cannot laugh, then you can be certain he does not know what truth is. Truth brings a sense of humor. Truth brings laughter. Truth brings a subtle happiness for no reason at all. Pramudita means joyous for no reason at all. You are sometimes joyous, but that is not pramudita, because it has a reason. Someday you have won in the race and you are very happy. What you will do every day, it is not going to happen. What you are going to do tomorrow? Or you have got a lottery and you are very happy. But this is not going to happen every day. One day I saw Mulla Nasruddin very sad, sitting in his veranda. I asked, what is the matter, Nasruddin? Why you are so sad? He said, 2 weeks before, my one uncle died and left me 50,000 rupees. So I said, this is nothing to be sad about. You should be happy. He said, yes, I was. And then next week, my another uncle died and left me 1 lakh rupees. So I said, why you are sad? You should be dancing. He said, I know. But now, no more uncle left. It cannot happen every day. Uncles cannot die. Your joyousness, if it is caused, is bound to turn into unhappiness sooner or later. It is on the way already. Watch out. If you have a cause to be happy, you are already getting into unhappiness. Because the cause will disappear. Only uncaused joyousness can be yours. And then nobody can take it away. Only saints and madmen are joyous for no reason at all. That's why there is a similarity between mad people and saints. A little similarity, overlapping. Their boundaries overlap. Both are very different. The saint is aware. The madman is absolutely unaware. But one thing is certain, both are happy for no reason at all. The madman is happy because he is so unaware, he does not know how to be unhappy. He is so unconscious that he cannot create misery. To create misery you need a little consciousness. And the saint is happy because he is so fully aware. How can he create misery? When you are fully aware, you create happiness for yourself. You become a source of your happiness. That's what Buddha means by pramudita. And he says this is the first ground. Second ground is vimal. It means innocence, purity, simplicity. Innocence, remember the word. If you become too knowledgeable, you lose innocence. If you become a pandit, you lose innocence. So don't go on gathering beliefs and knowledge, otherwise your innocence will be corrupted. If you don't know, you don't know. Simply say, I don't know. Accept your ignorance and you will be more innocent. And out of innocence, much happens. Never lose your childlikeness. I don't mean that you should be childish. To be childish and to be childlike are totally different. To be childish means irresponsible. To be childlike means simple, innocent, trusting. The third ground is prabhakari. It means luminousness, light. Feel yourself as a flame. Live as you are an inner burning light. Move with the inner flame. Do whatsoever you do, but always feel yourself as if you are made out of light. And by and by you will see a luminousness arising around you. It is already there. If you help, it will arise and you will have an aura. Now, Kirlian photographers even can take photographs of it. It is now very tangible. Man is made of bioelectricity. Everything is made of electricity. Electric seems to be the basic component of all. Ask the physicists. They say, matter consists nothing but of electricity. So everything is nothing but different formulations and combinations of energy. And Buddha says man is light. Light means electricity. You have just to recognize the fact. You have just to cooperate with it and you will become a great light. Not only unto yourself, you will become a light to others too. And wherever you will walk, there will be light. This is prabhakari, third grounding. Fourth grounding is arsimati, radiance, aliveness, vitality. The religious seeker should not be dull and dead. But ordinarily you will find these people. That's why I am interested in telling you about these groundings. Even Buddhists have forgotten. If you see a Buddhist monk, you will see pale, dead, dull, sleepy, in a stupor, somehow dragging, somehow carrying the burden of life, not interested. Buddha says, radiance, aliveness, vitality. This is the fourth grounding. Be alive, because it is only on the wings of life that you will reach to truth. If you are dull, you are lost. And be radiant. Because when there is no anxiety for the future and no desire for the future, then the whole energy is available to you. Then you can burn your torch from both the ends together. Fifth, Sudur Jaya. It means adventurousness, courageousness, challenge welcomingness. Whenever there is a challenge, welcome it. Don't avoid it. And whenever there is an adventure, don't escape. Go on the journey. Go on the trip. Nobody ever loses anything by being adventurous. I'm not saying that the path of adventure is full of roses. It is not. Roses are few and far in between. There are many thorns. But one grows, one becomes crystallized when one accepts a life of adventure. Ordinarily, people accept the life of security. No adventure. A good job, a good house, a good wife, a good husband, and good children. And people are satisfied. People are satisfied in living and dying comfortably, as if comfort is the goal. Then they never grow. Then they never achieve to any peaks. Then they never achieve to what Maslow calls actualization. They remain just a possibility. It is as if a seed has chosen to hide in the house and is not ready to go into the adventure of falling into the soil. It is dangerous because the seed will have to die. It is dangerous because the seed does not know what will happen when he has disappeared. No seed has ever known what happens after the seed has died. How can the seed know? The tree may happen, may not happen. Buddha says, Sudur Jaya. Look at the far. Sudur, that which is very far. Let that be your challenge. Don't be confined to the comfortable, to the familiar, to the secure. Don't make your philosophy based on the promises of a life insurance company. Have a little more courage. Move into the unknown. When you move into the unknown moves to you. When you are ready to drop your securities, God is also ready to drop His mysteries. When you are ready to be nude and available, God is also ready to be nude and available. He responds. He exactly responds to you. He never goes more than that you go. If you go towards Him, He comes towards you. If you escape, He also escapes. Sudur Jaya. And then sixth grounding, Abhimukhi. Immediateness. Face-to-faceness. Encountering that which is. Abhimukhi. Face-to-face. Immediateness. Don't bother about the past and don't bother about the future. face the truth as it comes, encounter the fact as it comes, and with no preparation, with immediateness. A man who lives by preparation is a pseudo man. In life there are no possibilities for rehearsals, but we all live through rehearsals. Before you come home, you start preparing what you are going to say to your wife. Can't you be immediate? Can't you wait for the moment when the wife is there and let what happens? Let it happen. But from the office, coming home, you are preparing what she is going to ask and what you are going to answer. Rehearsal. And then you are always clouded by your rehearsals. And you cannot see that which is. You always see through your clouds. Those clouds are very distorting. Buddha says, abhimukhi, immediateness. Be alert and let there be response. And whatsoever the result, don't be afraid of the result. People start rehearsing because they are afraid of the result, so they want to plan everything. There are people who plan everything. Every gesture is planned. And then their life is, of course, that of an actor. It is not real. It is not authentic. It is not true. And if your life is not true, then it is impossible for you to come to truth. Seventh, durangama, far goingness, accepting the call of the beyond. There is a beyond everywhere. We are surrounded by the beyond. That beyond is what God is. That beyond has to be penetrated. It is within, it is without. It is always there. And if you forget about it, as we do ordinarily, because it is very uncomfortable, inconvenient to look into the beyond, it is as if one looks into an abyss and one starts trembling. One starts feeling sick. The very awareness of the abyss, and you start trembling. So nobody looks at the abyss. We go on looking in other directions. We go on avoiding the real. The real is like an abyss, because the real is a great emptiness. It is vast sky with no boundaries. Buddha says, durangama. Be available to the beyond. Never remain confined to the boundaries. Always trespass boundaries. Make the boundaries if you need them, but always remember you have to step out. Never make imprisonments. We make many sorts of imprisonments. Relationship, belief, religion, they are all imprisonments. One feels cozy because there are no wild winds blowing. One feels protected. Although the protection is false, because death will come and will drag you into the beyond. Buddha says, before death comes and drags you into the beyond, you go on your own. A Zen monk was going to die. Suddenly he opened his eyes. He was very old, 90 years old. And he said, where are my shoes? And the disciple said, where are you going? Have you gone crazy? You are dying, and the physician has said that there is no more possibility. Few minutes more. He said, that's why I am asking my shoes. I would like to go to the cemetery, because I don't want to be dragged. I will walk on my own, and I will meet death there. I don't want to be dragged. And you know me. I have never leaned on anybody else, and this will be very ugly that four persons will be carrying me. No. He walked to the cemetery. Not only that, he dug his own grave, lied down in it and died. This is what Buddha means by Durangama. Such courage to accept the unknown, such courage to go on your own and welcome the beyond, then death is transformed. Then death is no more death. Such a courageous man never dies. Death is defeated. Such a courageous man goes beyond death. One who goes on his own to the beyond, beyond is never like death. Then the beyond becomes a welcome. If you welcome the beyond welcomes you. The beyond always goes on echoing you. Eighth, achala, centering, grounding, immovability. And Buddha says one should learn to be centered, unmoving, grounded. Whatsoever happens, one should learn how to remain unwavering. Let the whole world go into disappearance. Let the whole world dissolve. But a Buddha will go on sitting under his Bodhi tree, unmoved. His center will not be wavering. He will not go off center. Try it. By and by, you start coming closer to your center. And the more close you come, the more happy you will feel. And a great solidity will arise in your being. Things go on happening, but they are happening outside. Nothing penetrates to your center. If you are there, then nothing makes any difference. Life comes, death comes, success, failure, praise and insults, and pain and pleasure, they come and go. They all pass away. But the witnessing center always remains. Ninth, sadhumati, intelligence, awareness, mindfulness. Buddha is very much in favor of intelligence. But remember, he does not mean intellect by it. Intellect is a heady thing. Intelligence is more total. Intellect is borrowed. Intelligence is yours own. Intellect is logical, rational. Intelligence is more than logical. It is super logical. It is intuitive. The intellectual person lives only through arguments. Certainly, arguments can lead you up to a certain point. But beyond that, hunches are needed. Even great scientists who work through reason come to a point where reason does not work, where they wait for a hunch, for some intuitive flesh, for some light from the unknown. And it always happens. If you have worked hard with the intellect, and you don't think that intellect is all, and you are available to the beyond, someday a ray penetrates you. It is not yours, and yet it is yours. Because it is nobody else. It comes from God. It comes from your innermost center. It looks as if it is coming from the beyond because you don't know where your center is. To be intuitive. Intelligence Buddha uses in the sense of awareness, in the sense of mindfulness. The Sanskrit word sadhumati is very beautiful. Mati means intelligence, and sadhu means sage, sagely intelligence. Not only intelligence, but sagely intelligence. There are people who may be rational but are not reasonable. To be reasonable is more than to be rational, because sometimes the reasonable person will be ready to accept the irrational too, because he is reasonable. He can understand that the irrational also exists. The rational person can never understand that the irrational also exists. He can only believe in the limited, logical syllogism. But there are things which cannot be proved logically, and yet they are. And everybody knows they are. And nobody has ever been able to prove them. Love is. Nobody has ever been able to prove what it is, or whether it is or not. But everybody knows love is. Even people who deny that they are not ready to accept anything beyond logic, even they fall in love. When they fall in love, then they are in a difficulty. They feel guilty. But love is. And nobody is ever satisfied by intellect alone, unless the heart also is fulfilled. These are the two polarities inside you, the head and the heart. Sadhu Mati means a great synthesis of both head and heart. Sadhu means the heart, and Mati means the head. When the sagely heart is joined together with a sharp intelligence, then there is a great change, a transformation. That's what awareness is all about. And tenth, dharma megha, grace sovereign, becoming a cloud of truth, love and grace. Dharma megha. Have you watched? Just a few days before, there were so many clouds raining, showering on the thirsty earth. Buddha says, unless you become a showering of grace, you will not attain to the ultimate. The nine grounds are to prepare you. The tenth ground is the beginning of sharing. You start sovereign. Whatsoever you get, you have to share. Then you will get more. Whatsoever you have to shower. You have to give it to others. You have to distribute it. All that you attain in your being has to become your compassion. Then you will get more. The more, you will become a spendthrift of your inner energies. More space will be created for God to descend in you, for truth to penetrate you. That's why it is very difficult to know the truth and not to share it. It is impossible. Mahavir remained for 12 years silent. Then suddenly one day, he burst forth. What happened? For 12 years he was silent. Must have been moving into nine grounds. Then came the tenth. He became a dharma megha. He became a cloud of truth. And he started savoring. You cannot do anything about it. It is just like a flower opening and releasing its fragrance to the winds. It is just like a lamp burning and showering its lights all around. There is no way to prevent it. You cannot be miserly about truth. Buddha attained to truth, then for 42 years continuously he moved from one place to another, continuously talking, continuously saying what has happened to him. One day he was asked that you teach us to be silent, but you go on talking. Buddha said, I have to talk to teach you to be silent. Be silent that one day you can also talk. Be silent because in silence you will gather the juice. The flower remains closed until the right moment has come, when the fragrance is ready. Then it opens its petals, not before it. Be silent, be aware, be adventurous. One day, all these 9 bhumis, all these 9 grounds will prepare you to become a cloud. Then you will savor on people and you will share. Truth has always been shared in different ways. Meera danced. She knew how to dance the truth. Buddha never danced. Chaitanya sang. He knew how to sing. Buddha never sang. It depends on the individual. Whatsoever capacities you have, whatsoever creative possibilities you have, when truth will come into you, it will find out your possibilities, your creativities. Just the other night, a sannyasin was saying to me that it is very difficult. The more I am becoming meditative, the more I like to compose music. He is a composer. And he had stopped it. And now he thinks this is like a disturbance. But what is happening? Whenever I am feeling meditative, immediately great ideas arise in me. And I would like to compose. Now what to do? Should I stop it? There is no need to stop. Meditation brings your creativity to an expression. Whatsoever is hidden in you will become unhidden. Whatsoever you are carrying within you will be sung, will be danced, whatsoever it is. You will become a dharma megha. These 3 answers from 3 monks. So, 3 types of understandings: the bodily, the psychological, and the spiritual. Breath means spirit. That's why I call the 3rd understanding spiritual. If you have 1st understanding, then these 10 bhumis are not for you. If you have the 2nd type of understanding, then too, these 10 grounds are not for you. If you have the 3rd understanding, then these 10 grounds are for you. And unless you can become a dharma megha, remember your life was in vain. You lived without any purpose. You lived fruitless, barren, In fact, you lived not, you only appeared to live. So meditate on this small story of Buddha, his asking and the answers. Just meditate on it. I will tell you a few anecdotes to show you how we understand. A minister asked a little girl what she thought of her first church service. Well, she said, after giving the matter some thought, the music was nice, but the commercial was too long. Now a small girl, she knows only how to see TV. That is her understanding. And she knows music and commercial. In the church also, she thought the sermon was the commercial. She says the music was nice, but the commercial was too long. The couple were married 40 years. So she decided to get a checkup at the hospital. When she came home, she was ecstatic. The doctor says, "I am in perfect health." She bragged to her husband. In fact, he said, "I can have sex 12 times a month." "Wonderful," said the husband. "Put me down for 2. Now a businessman is a businessman. "Put me down for 2. Two corpses were laid out in the same room at the funeral home. One night when everybody left, one corpse sat up and asked the other, "What did you die from?" "Cigarettes," he answered. "I just smoked too many cigarettes." "What kind did you smoke?" "Raleighs," he answered. "At least did you save the coupons?" "Hell yes! How do you think I got this coffin?" Even people when they are dead will continue. Natural, it is natural, they will continue their old past, their old ways of understanding, calculation. The girl he saw was touring the army camps in Vietnam. At one outpost, arrangements were being made to feed them before leaving. "I say," said the officer in charge, "would you like to mess with the officers?" "Don't mind if we do, dear," said the leading lady, "but can't we have something to eat first?" Now a girl he saw is a girl he saw. Even words don't carry the meaning that they have. You put the meaning into them. Each time you utter a word, watch. Each time you listen a word, watch. Each time you make a gesture, watch. And you will see, whatsoever your level of understanding is expressed in all the ways. Seated in a restaurant, a priest was scrutinizing the beauty of a young lady escorted by her male companion. A layman kidded him about his female interest. "Just because I am on a perpetual diet, it does not mean I can't study the menu once in a while," said the priest. Your inner repressed, rejected, thrown into the basement, also goes on reflecting in your ways. Even sometimes when you avoid something, then too, in your very avoidance, your understanding shows it. The famous story of two Zen monks crossing a ford, they came across a woman, a very young and beautiful woman. She wanted to cross, but she was afraid. So one monk took her on his shoulders and carried her to the other shore. The other monk was furious. The other monk was fiery. It is prohibited. A Buddhist monk should not touch a woman. And this is too much, not only touching, he has carried the woman on his shoulder. The other monk remained quiet, but he was boiling within. Miles passed. When they reached the monastery, when they were entering the door, the other monk turned to the first and said, "Look, I will have to talk to the master. I will have to report it. It is prohibited." The first monk said, "What do you are talking about? What is prohibited?" He said, "Have you forgotten? You carried that young, beautiful woman on your shoulders. You should not touch." The first monk laughed and he said, "Yes, I carried her, but I left her on the other bank. Miles back, are you still carrying her?" Yes, the other monk was still carrying. Remember that your understanding is sown in every way. And if you watch correctly, your very watchfulness will take you to a further step. One unfortunate sailor was shipwrecked onto a desert island in the South Pacific. Fortunately, food and water were plentiful and the weather was perfect, so he survived in comparative comfort for 6 months, after which time, to his intense excitement, he spotted a small craft on the horizon. As it drifted in closer and closer, he could see that it was a ship's life raft containing one passenger. And as it got even closer, he saw this passenger was a young woman. Eventually, the raft splashed up on the beach and he ran towards her. She was a beauty, tall and willowy, and blonde and a cracker. "Hello, hello," said the poor lonely sailor. "Are you shipwrecked too?" "Yes, I am," she replied. "I have been here for 6 months," he said. "6 months," she exclaimed. "Well, then I am sure I have got something you have been missing. Don't tell me you have got a fag on you," he cried joyously. Your own desire, your own understanding, your own greed always is there in each response, in each reaction. If you watch closely, you will become aware that you go on sowing your understanding or misunderstanding in each moment of your life. Buddha's questions are very simple, and the monks who have answered may not have thought at all that they have any metaphysical significance. They may have even laughed at the ridiculous questions Buddha is asking to them. But by very simple questions, he has provoked their layer of understanding. The significance of their story is great. I never ask you any questions. But the questions you ask me are enough. They show everything about you. When I read your question, I am less concerned about your question than I am concerned with the questioner. More concerned with the questioner. That's why I insist you should always write your name under the question. You should always sign it. Because a question in itself means nothing. It becomes meaningful only when I know who is the questioner. My answer is not for the question, but for the questioner. One may ask the same question, and I may answer it in a different way. Another asks exactly the same question, with the same words, but I will not answer in the same way. Because it is not the question that is important. It is the questioner. Your question shows your understanding. Your question shows your confusion. Your question shows where you are. And I have to answer you where you are. Remember it. In darshan it happens many times, and it is better you should remember it. Many people come. Somebody asks a question. Others listen. You are allowed to listen. But those answers that I am giving to that particular person are not given for you. Otherwise there will be great misunderstanding. It happens sometimes that a questioner says something, I explain it to him, I help him to understand his problem. Another comes and he says, that's exactly my question too. And you have already answered. I say, no, don't be deceived so easily. You two are so different. In fact, there are no two similar persons in the world. So how your question can be the similar? You tell your question, you forget what I have said to the other. And then people become puzzled many times because they see that I can contradict myself. Just the other night, one person asked about fear, that I am afraid. I talked to him about death because I could see why he is afraid. Death was in his eyes. Death was around him. He was shadowed by death. I talked much about death rather than about fear, and he understood it. And I said to him, accept death and fear will disappear. The next person said, now there is no need to ask. I have also fear in me, and you have answered. I looked at the person, his fear has no relationship with death at all. His fear is fear of loneliness. It is a totally different dimension of fear. And I said, forget all about that I have said to the other person. It was not your question and it was not answered for you. You tell me about your fear. And by, it became clear that his fear has nothing to do with death. His fear is fear of being left alone. Fear that maybe my aloneness will always remain there. The first is afraid of death. The second is afraid that love, will it happen or not? His fear is in concern with love. Whether he will remain always alone or somebody will be there who will love him. And he will be able to love. Will there be a possibility that he will be with somebody together? and this constant wound of loneliness will disappear. He is not worried about death. He is worried about life. His fear is not concerned with death. His fear is concerned with life and relationship and communication and communion, love. They are totally different. They both use the word fear. And when I give different answers to different people, naturally, you can collect all the answers and you will see this man is mad. They will be contradictory. They are bound to be contradictory. My approach is individual. My approach is person to person. I try to relate with you as individuals. In the morning discourse, whatsoever I say, you can meditate over it. But whenever you are deciding to do something, ask me in darshan. Don't decide it by the morning discourse, because you are too many. And I am talking in a general way. The morning discourse is just to make principles clear to you. The darshan is to make practice clear to you, not principle. The morning discourse is just to make you aware that so many possibilities are there to grow and how to grow. But I am not talking to you personally, I cannot. Darshan is so that you can ask personal questions. You can approach me and you can see your face in my mirror. And I can see you directly into your eyes. The morning discourse is more philosophical, and the evening darshan is more religious. And if you can remember this difference, there will be great benefit out of it, a great understanding out of it. Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.